corporate acolytes and right-wing moralists constantly preach to laboring stiffs about the uplifting dignity of work. Of course, that's dignity as defined and controlled by corporate elites, not by workers, and the reward for it frequently includes on-the-job injuries and death. Not that CEOs and well-heeled investors intend to sicken, maim, and kill thousands of laborers every year, but they certainly do put them in positions that assure such unhappy results. For example, they demand that farm workers go sunrise to sunset picking crops in California's 105-degree desert heat, and that construction crews toil in the muggy dog days of Florida summers, tarring condo roofs. Low-paid, powerless workers die, but no one in the corporate hierarchy did the deed, right? Heat was the killer. But wait, not only are aloof, air-cool bosses the ones who knowingly subject subordinates to deadly heat, but they're also the ones who hire squads of lobbyists and lawyers to kill simple, inexpensive rules to stop these deaths. Such rules as requiring ample water at work sites, ensuring paid rest breaks in cool spaces, training on-site managers and employees to detect and react to signs of heat stress, and imposing serious punishments for violators. Such sensible steps have repeatedly been proposed as official workplace policy for at least the last 50 years, but intense industry lobbying has killed the adoption of all attempts to prevent what amounts to workplace murder by corporate profiteers. Instead, the U.S. government pretends to protect workers by printing posters admonishing employees to beware of heat, basically telling them goodbye and good luck. This is Jim Hightower saying, but at last a real proposal has been put on the table by more than 110 grassroots groups. See it and join it by contacting Public Citizen, citizen.org. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you lowdowners who subscribe to our monthly newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown. You know who you are. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Labor Day, you had college faculty at the Harrisburg Area Community College who were out in protest over the fact that the school's president and the Board of Trustees have been preventing them from being able to join and form their union. And this isn't new. Corporate America has been doing this for years. But you think an institution of higher learning wouldn't be as bad? No. Evidently, it's been over 250 days since these workers filed their petition for election and stalls, delays, you know, the stuff you would expect from an Amazon or getting from an institution of higher learning. And like I said, this isn't new. It's what they get away with because our laws are so badly antiquated and we absolutely need to get something done. But the folks, the Hawk Faculty United Group, chose Labor Day to send the message to their president. Tell them it's time to respect the organizing campaign, respect organized labor, and end the anti-union tactics. And here to share some thoughts on what happened on the big event day, I've asked Lewis Jones to come talk to us. Lewis is an adjunct professor of anthropology there at the Harrisburg Area Community College. Lewis, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rick. Thank you for inviting me.
So we got corporate hacks running hack. Am I getting this right? I mean, this seems like something right out of the Amazon playbook.
It everything that you're seeing is right out of the typical union busing playbook. Even the fact that, you know, they're using rhetoric to try to talk out both sides of their mouth. You know, on one hand, he's flat out stated he was against unions coming to this college. He was going to do everything he could to stop it. But at the same time, he says he's for social justice.
How's that work?
That's the question we're asking. How can you be for social justice and you're not for the democratic process, even with your own employees?
It's that benevolent dictator thing. I care as long as I control it and I say it's okay.
Exactly. And the thing about it is, he's not just hurting us, he's hurting our community, he's hurting our students. Because if we don't have the things we need, the ability to have the security we need to do our jobs, how are we going to focus on what we're there to do? We need to be able to focus on providing the best education for every one of our students so that then when they go out to that workforce, we're coming out fully prepared and providing the best possible employees for every job in the central in South Central Pennsylvania.
Now, there's this huge push because, you know, Joe Biden and the Democrats seem to have a plan that they want to expand community college opportunities. And I firmly believe that high school should now include an associate's degree. We should have 2 additional years of education because we need it. We need the job training. We need the skills. We need all of this stuff going forward. And not just community college, but vo-tech stuff as well. We need welders and we need pipe fitters and we need all of those. But we also need people who can work in hospitals and do the kind of training that you guys do. But I want people like you who are going to have some stability in the job. And also, I don't know, maybe not have to work 3 or 4 different jobs just to make ends meet. Maybe focus on the craft that you're training the next generation for. Does that seem like too much to ask for?
Actually, it's not. You know, and when you look at what's going on currently in higher education and at the community college level, tenure track has gone away. Everybody is using adjuncts exclusively. And when you're thinking about an adjunct's regular work week, they're not working at one place where they can devote all their time and spend it focused on what they're doing with the students. Because the pay that we receive, because we don't receive the benefits, we're having to work 2 and 3 different places just to make ends meet. And none of it, and think about it, we're not even getting benefits in most cases. We're not getting paid time off. We don't get sick time. If we get sick, we don't get paid.
Right.
We have to find somebody to take our place. And that's not how a job should operate.
And this
we need to be treated like professionals.
Absolutely. And this is where you go, we're entrusting you with the greatest resource this country has, the future. And this is how we treat the future makers. I mean, it's kind of sadistic if you stop and think about it.
Well, it's insidious. I mean, this is going back. We're working conditions that would be similar historically to what they worked in the 19th century, where you put in long hours for very low pay, no benefits, and at the end of the day, if they wanted to cash you aside, they could, and there's nothing you could do about it. And that's really what we're looking at today. I mean, unions have been very important in our history. They have balanced the scales. They've made it easier for people to actually get into the middle class. But now we're seeing that middle class be slowly whittled away, as we're seeing with union representation.
Yeah, I would argue it's not slowly, Lewis.
No, it's not slowly.
I argue not slowly. Because I've been saying for a while, and this is very serious, that we've got a Supreme Court right now who is marching us right back to the days of the Lochner era, where if you were hungry enough and desperate enough to work in poverty conditions for desperation wages, man, that was your choice. It was your liberty. And we're hearing the same kind of rhetoric, only instead of using liberty, we're using freedom. It's your freedom to be exploited. It's your freedom to be an adjunct, Lewis, because if you don't like it, you can go somewhere else. The only problem is, and you can tell us why you don't go somewhere else, because there's nowhere else to go.
Well, that's the thing. There are only so many positions out there. And when you consider that there are grad schools putting new students out every single year who are competing for those same jobs, so they know that they've got this rich pool that they can rely on, that they can pull from, because if we don't won't work for those low wages, they can find somebody else who will do it. Now, the problem is people are starting to rise up. We're starting to see even grad school programs where they're saying, hey, we need unions. We need representation. They were saying this when I was in grad school. We are being treated like cheap labor.
Yep.
We have no representation. We're getting an education. We're supposed to be professionals, but yet we're not being treated like professionals.
So now we're seeing this process drawing out. They're dragging this out as much as they possibly can. And they're, as we were talking off air a minute ago, they're doing all the things that you would expect any union buster to do. And I got to wonder, and I don't know if you know or if you don't know, but have they brought in one of these union busting firms to give them advice and to take money out of the system? Because it sounds like it. It sounds like they're doing all the things that's union busting 101, drag it out as long as you can, and then throw a whole bunch of people who nobody knows of on a list and go, oh, here, you don't have enough people to trigger an election. Is this the stuff that's going on?
Well, I don't know if they've hired anyone, but Ski has a history of doing this. Everywhere he's been, when they've tried to unionize, he's worked to stop it. His previous institution, he lost. They actually got the union. And once they got the union, he left. I mean, he's made a name that where he goes, he comes in to make cuts, he makes changes. And it's, and to be honest, what it's about is the bottom line. They're worried about how much money they're generating. They're not worried about how good a student they're putting out. And that's really what higher education is not a for-profit business, especially not the community college. Community college is supposed to be there to help your community and be the gateway to higher education for students to get them started. It's not about a profit generator, but that's not what they're doing. I mean, we've been constantly told that, you know, our budgets have to be cut. We're not generating enough money. But to be honest, over the past year and a half, they've had an excess because we haven't had to use buildings. Students are being taught by computers. We're sitting at home. You know, as an adjunct, I'm responsible for providing all the technology I need to teach. The college isn't going to provide it. If I want to teach, I've got to spend the money. And this is one of the things we're told. There is nothing being done other than the fact that they're putting the burden of trying to get what you need to be able to satisfy the needs of the students on the faculty. Specifically, when you got an adjunct faculty member who's not making, even $25,000 a year, how can they afford to go out and buy equipment that they need? And we certainly can't take it as a tax deduction.
That's crazy. I mean, and the thing is you guys have spent years, you know, honing your craft, learning, spending money on the education system as a whole, only to find out that, you know, they're trying to squeeze you out of this. So, you know, where do you guys go from here? Because clearly they're going to drag this out. Now, fortunately, you know, the Biden administration, the NLRB there is going to be a little more friendly. I don't know how much more immediately, but how do you see this playing out in the coming days, weeks, and months?
Well, we actually have a hearing coming up tomorrow to try to resolve this issue. The PLRB, PSEA, who's the union that we've chosen to work with, and HAC will be meeting, and there will be testimony. Myself, actually, I will be testifying as to what constitutes employment as an adjunct. Because, for example, they're trying to say that we are employed even when we're not getting paid, simply because they say we're an employee. But any job I ever had, if I wasn't getting paid, I wasn't an employee. And so we're going to be sitting down and having this hearing tomorrow, and that's going to be the first step towards trying to resolve this issue. And HAC is going to still continue to try to stall.
Right.
That's a guarantee. But we feel good that the PLRB is going to see the facts for what they are. Not only do we have enough people who have signed the cards, we've made the 30% threshold, but that HAC's actually been acting in bad faith. When you've been asked to turn in the names of everybody who's eligible to be a part of the voting block, and you wait 5 months to turn something in, then you turn something in that has more names than what you should have for people who haven't even been employed, that tells you right there that they're not operating from the idea of, we're trying to be democratic. We're trying to be fair.
No, they're trying to pad the numbers to ensure that they've got enough votes to suppress this. And you know, my fear becomes, you know, we're in this weird world, Lewis, where, you know, gig employment now seems to be at an all-time high. I'm surprised they haven't gone to trying calling you guys independent contractors at some point and not employees at all, because of the way that, you know, your contracts are short-term and all the things that they can do to just get rid of you. I mean, this is where, if I'm you, I want the protection of something in writing. I want that contract that every CEO in this country has, and that every working person should have. If I'm you, I want it.
Well, and that's all we want. We want the security that comes with true employment. You know, I teach at another college, and they give me an annual contract every year. And well before I'm ready, that year is up, I'm signing my next year's contract. I know how many classes I'm teaching. I know what semesters I'm teaching, what classes are. With HAC, I have to wait and typically till almost the middle end of a semester to find out if I can actually say if there's going to be a class I can teach. And then, to be perfectly honest, I can have that class pulled right out from under me up until the first day of classes.
So let me ask you this, given that reality, how much are you concerned about retaliation and them just saying, well, you know, got no more classes for you, Lewis?
Well, you know, I'm willing to put myself out there for it. Because, one, if they retaliate, there are recourses that I have because of the fact that I have been out in public with my support for the union. The SEA will support me. They have supported, they will support any of us who are standing out there. Because of the fact that we have the constitutional right to organize. We have the right to speak our minds and say what is going on and why we want a union. If they don't want to hear that, that's their choice. But if they retaliate against me, funny enough, I can retaliate back against them equally.
And there is a recourse. And again, I go back to, we have a different National Labor Relations Board and potentially different outcomes. So let me ask you this, because, you know, you've got this legal side of this. You're going forward with the hearings. You guys are moving in that direction. But a bigger part of this, in my view, is always the political part, the PR campaign. You know, what kind of responses are you getting from students? What kind of responses are you getting from the rest of the faculty and moving this forward? Because I can't imagine that this is sitting too well with this long drawn out affair that's going on.
No, I mean, students are concerned because, and students have been complaining simply because they feel like they're not getting what they should be getting from the college. And of course, that drives a lot of what we're doing at why we organize, why we want a union, because we're looking at the fact that we lost all of our counselors for the students. They got rid of all of our professional counselors. Actually, they asked adjuncts to fill in for them over a year ago because they got rid of them all. They've cut down on librarians. I mean, right now, we've got very few classes that are being taught on campus. We're still, even though other colleges are coming back in person, HAC is still doing things virtually or online. I'm one of the few people teaching at the Gettysburg campus who's actually teaching on campus. You walk through the halls, it's like a tomb. The students remark on the fact that it's hard to get the things they need. So if they want to get books, I have a student in my class who couldn't get their books because they weren't available. They didn't order enough for the bookstore, so they sold out. But they know how many books they need per section if it's going to be a full section. So there's no excuse for this. So there's a lot of people missing from the college who would have filled in and made these things possible for students. And so faculty, we're not happy.
No.
And anybody I talk to has got the same thing. They worry about, is HAC going to be here in a few years?
Yeah,
if HAC keeps going the way it's going, there's not going to be a HAC in existence.
It doesn't sound like a good environment right now. And this is why, again, the people who are closest to it, the working people, should have a say in what's going on. So last question I've got for you. How can we help? How can we move this forward? Because ultimately, I want you guys to have a say. I want you guys to have some ability to make changes there. What do we do to help?
I mean, the number one thing that can be done is we need not just the faculty and students to be speaking forth. We need our community to speak up. We need the people who actually have a vested interest in the success of HAC to speak up and let the administration and the trustees know that they need to stop and listen. They need to actually become part of the solution, not the problem. If they believe in social justice, they believe in the democratic values that this country is supposed to be founded on, there should be no problem with them allowing us to get to our vote to determine whether we're going to have a union or not. The fact of the matter is the faculty wants to get to the next step so that we can move into what's important, and that's working with our students to ensure their success. And so if the community speaks up, they have to listen.
There you go. Lewis, I appreciate you taking time for me. I wish you guys the best. Good luck in your testimony tomorrow. I hope all goes well. And like I said, anything we can do to help, we're here for you.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Good stuff. Lewis Jones, adjunct professor of anthropology there at the Harrisburg Area Community College. I mean, this is disgraceful in my view. And I hope the state actually does something to step in and help. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day the Delano grape strike began in California. The strike came a year after activists had forced Congress to end the Bracero contract labor program. The Filipino Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, led by Larry Itilong, Philip Vera Cruz, and others, called the strike against the Delano growers and the Coachella Valley grape growers. It had been a record harvest. Farm workers demanded higher wages, humane working conditions, and union recognition. When the growers refused, thousands walked out of the fields. A week later, the Mexican-American National Farm Workers Association, led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, joined the strike. It was a historic moment. Within a year, the two unions would merge to form the United Farm Workers. The union sent strikers to the Oakland docks to persuade the longshoremen not to load non-union grapes. Many of the Filipino workers in the San Joaquin Valley worked in the Alaska fish canneries organized by the ILWU in the off-season. And so the ILWU honored their union brothers' request. Thousands of cases of grapes were left to rot on the docks. This initial victory led Chavez to organize a grape boycott against heavyweights DiGiorgio and Shenley Industries. 6 months into the strike, union leaders marched 300 miles from Delano to Sacramento to bring attention to their struggle. They hoped to pressure growers to the negotiating table and legislators to act on their behalf. For 5 years, the strike and boycott continued with marches, organizing, and picket line arrests. Gradually, the UFW began winning higher wages, union recognition, and hiring halls. Finally, in 1970, a collective bargaining agreement covering 10,000 workers was reached.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Hey, podcast fans, have you heard about MSW Media? It's your one-stop shop for some of the best progressive voices in the business. At MSWmedia.com, you'll find shows like Justice Matters with Glenn Kirshner, The Bureau with Frank Figluzzi, shows with hosts like Greg O'Lear and Zev Shalev, and of course, Renato Mariotti, just to name a few. One of our personal favorites, The Daily Beans with Dr. Allison Gill. And of course, you can get The Rick Smith Show there too. Go to MSWmedia.com for all these great shows and more. And help us push back against the right-wing hate machine, one download at a time.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I saw this this story. Evidently, the Republican governor of Oklahoma, this Kevin Stitt, his house is on the market. $4.5 million in Oklahoma. You know, again, you know, you go, wow, $4.5 million. You know, just you know. And my problem is we've got this situation where there's so few working people who are in these positions. And you go, $4.5 million, that's not a lot. I don't know. In Oklahoma? Maybe I just don't know the property values in some of these places. It's a nice place. You know, it's a gigantic place. And I guess good for him, but it puts me in one of these moments, in one of these moods where you go, exactly, you know, these folks in these positions, what do they know of what it's like to actually, you know, worry about, you know, making sure that there's food on the table for the kids, making sure that there's, you know, opportunity for the kids to go to a community college where the adjunct professors who evidently now dominate the community college are being, you know, treated poorly. I mean, you know, the whole education thing is so screwed up right now because, you know, and Lewis hit on it. It's all about the profit. They run these, they're all bean counters, not really educators. They're all bean counters. How much money can we bring in? How much can we put in the endowment? How much can we roll over into next year? How much can we? And you go, this is because our political system is nuts because we've got Republicans who are going, no, we need to cut taxes on the rich people. We need more tax cuts. We need more tax cuts for rich people so that they'll do what rich people do, make more money for themselves. Instead of going, hey, you know, we need to have a reasonably high tax rate so that we can, oh, I don't know, fund something like the community college so that the community can go to the college at a reasonable price. And, oh, I don't know, learn maybe a new skill, get a new trade. You know, oh, I don't know. learn a little enlightenment, have a little, you know, I know, too much to ask for, Rick, too much. But you look at where we are with our tax code. Our tax code is horribly broken. And, you know, I saw this thing over, you know, the Treasury Department put out this this little do-to-do that pointed out that every year we're losing about $600 billion in what they're calling the tax gap. The tax gap is the gap between what we're what's supposed to come into the federal government and what actually comes in. And they're saying it's about a $600 billion each and every year kind of thing. And they're saying, look, you know, it's $7 trillion over a decade when you look at this number. And you go, $7 trillion, what could we do with $7 trillion over a decade? Huh. We could easily pass that $3.5 trillion decade plan that Biden's got. We could do that. We could invest in making sure that kids get to go to community college, and we could even pay professors a reasonable wage. Maybe even get them health care. Maybe let their kids go to school. Huh, there's a thought. You know, maybe we can invest in, you know, making sure that granny gets some new chompers and some of those hearing things. Maybe even some glasses so she can see where she's going. Maybe, just a thought. We could do so much. We could invest in such opportunity for the future. But no. Can't do that. What we have to do, is we have to make sure that the very wealthiest don't pay their taxes. And what they pointed out is the amount that we're losing is about 3% of GDP. Or this is the one that caught me. It's about 3% of the GDP. Or all of the income taxes paid by the bottom 90% of taxpayers. Let that sink in for a second. Our top 1%, they're the ones who they choose not to pay because they can afford to hire tax avoidance lawyers. They can hire teams of them. You know, this is, to me, why Trump never wanted to give his tax returns over, because he didn't want people to see what vehicles he was using to line his pockets. But they went through by percent, by, you know, where you are in the percent of the population, and the top 0.5%, an estimated, their estimated underpayment of taxes is over 20%. Over $120 billion. Just those handful of people at the very top. But no, we can't possibly have people who are going to be able to delve into their tax returns and make them stop cheating, because it's complicated. So what do? We take money away from those folks. We defund the people who are going after the big cheats, and we focus them on those little cheats. And this is brilliant strategy by the Republicans. It really is. Because, understand, this is how the world works. The conservative movement has invested heavily, heavily in think tanks. They pay a lot of really smart people, and they find them day one in college, and they cultivate them, they groom them, they train them to be the next generation of big corporate thinkers. And they lie around all day long and they think of, hey, how can we, you know, we tear this down? How can we break this? How can we, you know, message this? And what do people hate more than anything? Taxes. They have spent so much time, energy, and money on messaging. Look, I hate paying taxes as much as anyone, but it's how we get our kids to go to school. It's how we pave the roads. It's how we do all of the things that we need, that we think are important. But what they do, and they do it masterfully, constantly hammering you with it. The reason they don't go after the rich people, because it's hard. It's a lot of hard work, because other smart people are going, no, we're smarter than you. You will not catch us. Go after those poor dumb people who, you know, Donald Trump loves so much. He loved the poorly educated. And this wasn't invented under Donald Trump. This was invented mostly under the George W. Bush administration, when they were the ones who basically defunded going after rich people. And where did they put them? Going after poor people. because you want poor people to hate the government and hate the IRS and not see it as an opportunity to tax the rich to make sure that they get the things that they need. It's brilliant. And I give them credit. Look, they're a lot smarter than the mass of us, which is why they get paid a really lot of money. And some of them can afford $4.5 million homes. It's quite remarkable when you stop and think about it. And then you combine that with they continue to tell us that, sorry, you know, your work isn't worth anything. To where finally, and this is, you know, I saw this story, I think it was over at CBS. They finally pointed out what I've been saying for years. Had the minimum wage kept up with productivity, it'd be like $25 an hour. They say now, thanks to the little bit of inflation we've had because of the pandemic, it's actually up to $26 an hour had it just kept up with productivity over the last 50 years. This isn't news to anyone. But yet, in 20 states across this country, mostly in the South, the Midwest, and oh, Pennsylvania, the federal minimum wage hasn't moved in 12 years now. And in fact, the state of Pennsylvania, our minimum wage is still $7.10 an hour. Or no, 7.15. That's right, 7.15, nothing in between. That was the battle cry back during the Ed Rendell years. And when the federal government raised it to 7.25, that's when it became 7.25. But our state minimum wage is still 7.15. And yet there's no push. There's no push here to raise that. There's no push to, remember, they told us, meritocracy, Rick, meritocracy. Work hard. Play by the rules, get ahead. Meritocracy. And yet at $7.25 an hour for the last 12 years, as productivity has continued to rise, wages have been deadlined. And for a lot of people, and right now there's a little bit of wage inflation going, a little bit. I hear people going, yeah, I got a raise. Oh, that's great. I go, do you have it in writing? Well, no. I said, you probably should get a contract. You should, now is the perfect time to join a union. Everything that they're giving you to keep you there, make sure you get to keep it. Because when this turns around, you know they're going to claw it back. You know they're going to take it back. Because they can. It's that simple. Love to hear your thoughts. Are they giving you raises? Do you think you're worth $26 an hour? Has your productivity gone up that much? I know most people's has. Love to hear your thought. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed a permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, Kellyanne Conway cracked me up today. Loving it. Loving the fact that Kellyanne was all ripped off. She, Joe Biden has said, hey, look, you people who were appointed to the military academic advisory boards who were appointed by the last guy, you got to go. You're either going to voluntarily go or you're going to go. People like former National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, Sean Spicer, who was actually in the Navy Reserve, so I don't see him as not being on there. And, of course, Kellyanne Conway, who I don't know why she's on one of the service academies advisory boards. Not quite getting – other maybe it's a paying gig that she can line her pockets, but she's – she's not thrilled. She said, frankly, I find the whole act unconscionable and not all in the spirit by which this administration promised to govern. She came from the guy, the last guy. This is who she came from. She goes on, President Biden ran on a supposed platform of unity, but his actions speak directly to the contrary. Apparently, unity is only for those who conform. I just find it really ironic coming from her. Just my thoughts. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, I've asked our good friend Bob Ney to come back and talk with us. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So what is Kellyanne Conway doing on an advisory board overseeing our military academies?
Well, these are, they're political appointments, so you're going to get some people that are qualified. Sean Spicer, as you said, has a background. There's also a retired Air Force colonel on there, Legenfelder, and he's the acting chair of the Air Force Academy Visitors Board, because there's a visitors board also that, was created. And so he's somebody that, has got a background. Kellyanne Conway was just a political appointment. I'm kind of curious why she picked that.
I don't know. Is it a paying gig? I mean, is this how she gets her health insurance, which is why she's so ticked off?
I don't think so. I mean, I could be wrong. Maybe it is. But I just, of all the things she could have gotten, because let's face it, she could have gotten anything she wanted.
Yeah.
I'm wondering why she took this. Surely there was something else, but maybe there's a reason she wanted it. I don't know. I mean, I totally forgot about the boards.
Yeah, I mean, but this is I think, a failure of this administration, because shouldn't this stuff have been done months ago?
Oh, well, now on that issue, you better believe it. Look, we all know when new administrations come in, you want your own people in, and appointments are always, questionable. Can the White House get rid of them? Well, they are, and if they don't resign, then, they'll fire them, and then it can go to court. Which, she'll take it to court, obviously, for the publicity factor.
Sure.
But bottom line is, appointments usually, in a lot of cases, serve at the pleasure of the appointing authority, which in this case is the president. And that's how a lot of them work. But you're right. Traditionally, when you go in, get it over with, because if I remember right, Alberto Gonzalez waited, and of course that's what got him in deep trouble, when he started getting rid of a lot of people, and I don't think he got rid of them right away. I think he waited till later.
Yeah.
But that did surprise me about this, because I don't know why when they came in, just go through it all once. One time. Get it all done.
Yeah, now, do you think it has anything to do with the fact that it was such a long, there was really no transition period? I doubt that they really coordinated. But I got to be honest, Biden should have, their team should have had all this stuff mapped out to where on day one, everyone hits the ground running, because, look, they were there once before. I mean, he was in the vice president's seat, but he still knew where the bathroom was.
Right, and they slipped up on this. The other thing I think they should have done with this, personally, is get rid of Kellyanne Conway, leave some of the others, the press secretary said about, well, you know, they're not qualified. Well, you're going to have a hard argument even on Sean Spicer. He might be political, but, you know, he's got a background.
Yeah, he was in the Naval Reserve. Now, the other woman, this stirrup woman, she's got no, she's just a political hack who I don't think belongs on there, and I don't think they should be on there anyway. But you're right, H.R. McMaster. You know, there's a guy who, he's got plenty of experience.
Yes, he's former National Security Advisor and retired Army Lieutenant General. So what they could have done was, what I think they should have done was to go in and eliminate the ones that were very, very clearly a political appointment. Like,
yep,
Kellyanne Conway, and leave the rest alone. Then they can say, well, wait a minute. We left the former press secretary alone, you know, and then get rid of the other ones that they wanted. So, I don't know. It's kind of a lot to do about nothing in the sense of creating this at this point in time. It's not going to, you know, affect the administration, to be frank. But, again, I don't know why they just didn't do it early. Maybe somebody missed it and ran into the chief of staff of the White House and said, hey, we missed this one. Let's do it now. I don't know.
They got stuck in the spam filter in their email.
Right.
No, but, you know, the reason I bring this up is because, you know, the former guy, you know, this was his MO. I mean, he was firing his own people, not even the people from the past administration. Yeah, he did that, but he was firing his own people all the time. So this should not be unusual.
He fired his own people sometimes before he fired the last administration's people, or they quit. You know, I mean, he had one of the largest turnovers in history, and so yes, when you compare, you know, administrations, I think the press secretary can say, look, you know, you're actually criticizing us when, you know, the last administration fired basically almost everybody that you know, crossed their path. But again, waiting for this and having this come up, it's just sort of like, okay, why did they do that now? Not why did they do the firings? They have the right to do them, but
right.
Why now?
Good point. Why now?
Yeah,
when I saw it, I'm going, this should have been done on day one.
Right.
I don't know how now, fortunately, they got rid of Peter Robb, you know, general counsel at the NLRB, made me very happy. Got rid of his number two as well, made me equally happy. That was important. Maybe you skipped this one. I don't really care, but it should have been done on day one. Wanted to get your thoughts. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, I was saying you're completely right.
But speaking of the former guy, I don't know if you saw this story that evidently he's going to be doing some color commentary on 9/11 of the Evander Holyfield Victor Belfort boxing match. Evidently going to spend the whole evening on 9/11, you know, doing a little commentary of boxing. Is this bad taste?
It's so strange. I mean, I know, you know, in his previous life before he became president, he was involved, you know, with WWE and things. I think it's so weird. They've got the boxing match, and Evander Holyfield is going to, you know, be out there boxing versus Belfort. And any other time, I would say that, well, you know, if Trump wants to do that, that's fine. Although I would question, and I know he, you know, appeals to certain groups, but I would still even question doing this if it wasn't on 9/11 doing it. You know, I don't see this thing as something the former president does. But now doing it on 9/11, it's just, you know, it's a day that he just shouldn't have done it on that day. He should have done some other event that would have, you know, been apropos to the day and the thoughts in the morning of people. So and it's the 20th anniversary. I thought it was very, very strange. And if it wasn't on September 11th, I still thought it was.
No. Yeah. I mean, you know, the last 2 days, I've invoked your memory and your name here, on, you know, with you know, with September 11th coming up and talking about, you know, we're 20 years on now,
right.
And I want to go back and I want fully investigated and fully brought into the public eye all of the lies that were told that got us into all of our wars, all of the things that. That we were sold and you know, look at, you know, Does the Patriot Act serve our needs? Does the Department of Homeland Security serve our needs? Are these things that we need to be looking back at and maybe breaking up and giving us some of our privacy back and stopping this pursuit of a surveillance state?
Right. I mean, there's a lot, and again, that they can dissect on this entire situation from 9-1-1 forward, that 9-1-1 then was used, or the fact of 9-1-1 was used to create certain things that have passed their time. You know, of course, the Iraq War was one of them, but as you mentioned, the Patriot Act and what they were really trying to seek. You know, of course, I was one of three Republicans that voted against it. Everybody was all on board at the time, but some of the best constitutional attorneys in the country were in telling everybody, look, you know, you can do this in a different manner that would be, you know, better for people's rights and you know, civil rights, but it came about. And I think that we repeat so much, as they say, the old phrase, repeating history, if we don't go back. And there's nothing wrong with going back, and especially at this point in time, with this whole look at the Afghanistan, you know, exit, they really are going to be committing a terrible political sin, but a more important, a public policy sin, if they don't go and look at the whole broad picture, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
No, I'm right there. I'm right there with you. You know, at some point, you've got to go back and hold people accountable.
Exactly.
We've never done that. And look, you know, some of them, you know, like Rumsfeld has passed on. There are a lot of people who have passed on. And now it's time to find out what went wrong, how it went wrong, so we don't make the same dumb mistake again.
Do it again.
I shouldn't say dumb mistake, because I firmly believe we were walked into this, and we, the public,
right,
walked into it thinking it was going to be another example like you know, the first Iraq War. It was going to be a weekend in the sand, and it was going to be home to big parties, and hooray, we won. And here we are 20 years on.
Right. And of course, we were going to make Iran less powerful, and you know, everything you heard from the whole Bolton crowd at that point in time, and the newspapers, you know, the media for the most part went along with a lot of things without questioning it, and so it's time to go back. And other people say, well, let it all lie. It's, you know, Saddam was a bad guy. That's not a great excuse to ignore the truth, or what was the truth at the time.
Yeah, I see. I hit a line earlier today where, you know, George W. Bush was saying, you know, they hate us for our freedoms. And they hate us for our freedoms so much. Why are you taking them away?
Exactly. And I think that somebody needs to take a look. And this is the opportunity. And again, if they're going to investigate this, if they narrow it to just leaving Afghanistan, then I think it's a hit against public policy.
No, I'm with you. So let me ask you, with 9/11 coming up, I mean, you know, we've been talking the last couple of days about how the world has changed, you know, how we knew on you know, September 11th that the world was changed. We just didn't know how bad it was going to be. At least I didn't. You know, when you look back over these last 20 years, what do you think?
Oh, I think, you know, when it came to the Capitol, you know, we were trying to adjust afterwards, and people were pressuring. When I say we, Steny Hoyer was the ranking member of the House Administration Committee that I chaired. And there was such a movement way back then of people, members, and trying to push to, you know, stop tours and do this and plexiglass in or bulletproof in the chamber. And just how that started in itself, I thought to myself, wow, this will calm down at some point in time. We'll do the right thing, which, you know, Steny Hoyer did and the committee did. But, you know, this attitude will calm down. It will, you know, people will adjust to it and, you know, be protective, but do it in a decent manner. And I don't think that happened. I think just it went, you know, across the United States in such a way that it was the next emergency bill that you could bring up that, you know, restricted somebody's freedom. I mean, there was a fear, you know, across the country of what was going to happen next, and how we had to prevent every single thing from happening, and how were we going to do that, and how we were going to do more surveillance. And so I think it did dramatically, you know, change the country in, you know, not so good ways sometimes.
Is there any way back? I mean, you know, like I tell my kids, the country I grew up in when I was their age is not the country they're growing up in. I mean, they're used to being surveilled at every time. The school can flip on their laptop and see what they're doing. Their cameras all over the place. You know, they've got the phones that are tracking their every movement. Is there any way back, or is this we've gone down the slippery slope way too far and fast?
I think we have. I think we've went down too far and too fast. You know, one thing I found in the last 10 years of talking to a, you know, great number of people and doing radio across the U.S., et cetera, I would bring up many times the issues of surveillance and, you know, public policy. Well, for example, when they wanted the shooter's phone that shot up the Orlando gay bar, the government came in and wanted, you know, every phone to have access points placed in them, you know, in the beginning. And they said, well, they can't open the phone. That's not true. There's hackers that can open any phone, you know. And at that point in time, I remember when I ran stories about it, a lot of younger people just were like, man, you know, it's not a big deal. If you're not doing anything bad, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But people that were older are like, wait a minute, you know, you can't take that attitude. But I think too many young people have been raised with the cameras and surveillance, as you said, and the cell phones and the tracking and the Google tracking and everything that happens, that there's just a whole generation. And as each, you know, year goes on, there's more younger people that are just accustomed to, you know, this is the way it is. And I don't care if I'm tracked or not. I think they're just, you know, it's a generational thing, unfortunately.
It's crazy. And mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I don't understand my kids' thinking, because for me, I'm private. I don't want, there are things, sure, that I think, you know, you keep to yourself. Not everything needs to be broadcast. And this, you know, and I don't want to sound like an old curmudgeon, but it's one of those things where you go, some things are private.
Well, right. And again, I experienced the same thing with my family. My kids aren't, you know, they're not fazed by it. Especially my teenage grandchild is just not fazed by it like I am. And you kind of preach, wait a minute, shouldn't we, you know, at least have some rights? I look at it as a rights issue, and just a lot of younger people don't feel that way.
Yeah. Interesting times. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on, and do you see a way back? I mean, we're too far down the road, right?
I think we are. I mean, I always hate to, you know, in my lifetime of seeing some things change, you know, sometimes for the good, I always hate to say, well, never, but unless somebody takes the charge on this thing, then I just don't see how it's going to change.
Yeah. Last question I got for you. I forgot about Ohio. Tomorrow, your maps get dropped tomorrow. Anything you expecting? Any colorful? I mean, you were in the House for a number of years. Any right. Colorful redistricting coming out tomorrow?
Oh, I imagine there's always going to be. I haven't heard what's, you know, in there, but there's going to be something. When my last time that I ran, they put a thumbnail in my district where my house was, literally a thumbnail, and eliminated two counties, which I wanted to keep because they were Democratic counties that I would win by 10,000 plurality per county. So I loved them, you know, and they put a thumbnail right in there, one township, and then they drug it all the way down to southern Ohio. It made the district a six-hour round trip. So, you know, I experienced it, lived through it. I think anything's possible. There'll be some interesting changes. They do stay away a lot from Cuyahoga County in Cleveland, which is, you know, your home area. They stay away from that because of racial lines.
Right.
So they kind of usually do. I would be shocked if they, you know, if they would do something funny up there.
Yeah, you mean like that whole snake on the lake thing?
Right. Snake on the lake, right.
Crazy. But Bob, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend Bob Ney. Let's take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
This day in labor history, the year was 1941. The ravages of World War II had swept across Europe. German troops had invaded Norway in April of 1940. The conditions of the Nazi occupation grew increasingly harsher. The Nazis began rationing milk, an important part of the diet of Norwegian children and workers. The rationing, however, did not apply to the German occupiers. Angered shipyard workers in Oslo walked off the job in protest. Workers from other industries joined them. 20,000 workers from 50 factories and work sites participated in the strike. The Nazi response to the uprising was predictably swift and brutal. 200 labor leaders were arrested and new Nazi chosen leaders put in their places. 27 of the arrested labor leaders and strikers were brought before a court-martial trial. Rolf Wickstrom, a welder and union steward, and Harald Viggo Hanstein, a labor lawyer, were sentenced to death for their involvement in the strike and executed. The remaining 25 strikers were convicted and sentenced to long prison sentences. Ludwig Bulin, a union railway worker, died while serving his prison sentence. So did Harry Vesely, a factory worker. Journalists were fired or arrested. Even groups like the Boy Scouts were banned. Listening to foreign broadcasts on the radio were expressly forbidden. Then radios were confiscated. In Sweden, trade unionists issued this statement in support of their fellow Scandinavian workers. They wrote, quote, "Norwegian trade unionists have fallen in the battle for Norway's freedoms and for the right of the Norwegian working class to decide for itself its own actions with the limits of Norwegian law. We honor their memory." In 1948, a memorial was placed to honor the deaths of Wickstrom and Hanstein and the workers who stood up for their country. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
A couple of quick emails. Steve writes, "I totally agree with you regarding manufacturing. I enjoy your show and these short pieces about labor history. Unions will always be the right way to bring truth to power." Appreciate that, Steve. It's nice to get an email from somebody who's not being ridiculous. And you could do that. You can send nice emails occasionally if you'd like, just not the hateful, angry ones. I like the hateful, angry ones. But you know, try and spell a little bit better next time. Wendy writes, "Rick, love the Jeep. Make sure you wave." Evidently, that's a thing with Jeep owners. I guess I'm going to have to learn that. I never got it with my Patriot, but maybe this is a different level of Jeep. And John writes, "Thank you for buying American-made products. Thank you for looking for the union label. We need more people who are willing to do just that." And like I said at the beginning, the job that you may end up saving may be your own. That's why I do look, and I look a lot, no matter what it is. You know, on Labor Day, we were out, and I just stopped at the store, and I don't do it often, but it was Labor Day. We bought some hamburger rolls and some other things. And, you know, the first thing I'm looking for the union bug on the back. And I actually tweeted it out because I think those things are important. Those things are there to make us know that, hey, people need to make a decent living. And these products were made by people who were doing just that. So for me, the union label means a decent life. People are earning a decent living, have reasonable conditions that they're working under. All good stuff in my view. And like I said, it may even be your job. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You want to follow us on social media, on Twitter @RickSmithShow, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, all that stuff. Don't forget the YouTube video, podcasts everywhere, all that stuff. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.